Good morning and welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. It's the 15th of September, but the key word is that it's Friday, and we thank you for being with us and for sharing part of your day with us this morning. We have a lot to talk about. I was putting together a list of stories, and I was trying to contain them last night and trying to keep them down to a reasonable length, and then all kinds of stuff happened overnight, and so we've got a lot to talk about, and we'll get to all of that in a moment. Let me introduce our panel to you. But first, a quick reminder that you can join us. We love your letters for the most part. Panel@WAMC.org. panel@WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you. We have Judith Enck with us. It's wonderful to have her back. She is, of course, former EPA regional administrator, and we are thrilled to have her on our program this morning and most Friday mornings. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, most Fridays. It's a fun routine.
Very nice to have you here. Communications consultant Joe Bonilla is with us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Also great to have you on the program. Two absences this morning. Aaron Pisidia is away, so we'll welcome him back next week. And, of course, our own Alan Chartok is on vacation this week, and he'll be back, I believe, middle of next week. So that'll be good as well. Meanwhile, we're waiting for Malcolm Nance. Malcolm Nance is a counterterrorism expert. He is also an MSNBC commentator. And because of the bombing in London this morning, they tapped him, and we were just watching it just moments ago. He was on a television. So in the time that it takes him to get into his car, I don't think he's going to change out of the suit, but I don't know.
You never know.
And those spies do neat things, don't they? And he'll be over. He could just be like in like basketball shorts. Yeah. You know, just have the shirt and tie.
Or a Superman shirt.
Yeah, we don't know. So
just up top, part in the bottom. There
that's
you go.
Right. That's right. And so he'll be here momentarily, and we'll talk to him about what's going on. We want to obviously talk to him about London. We obviously want to talk to him about North Korea. But let us start then. That would probably start us off normally, but since Malcolm is going to be with us in a few minutes, I would like to start off on pretty much what we've been promising for the last several days, is that we would talk a lot about what has been happening with the climate and the questions over climate change, as well as the destruction of caused by Irma, and well as the cleanup continues in Texas as well over Harvey. The Irma story, of course, in Florida is tragic, but when you look at what happened in the Caribbean, it is really stunning, the damage that was done in the Caribbean. Interesting to note is that Judith Enck's area, when she was regional administrator, not only included New York and New Jersey, but also included Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. So you know this area very, very well.
Yeah, I do. And I've been watching with tremendous concern over the last week.
So the reports that we're getting is that it hit the Virgin Islands. It hit the Caribbean as a Category 5 hurricane. It was most said that it's virtually unrecognizable, mm-hmm. Like going into another planet. I've heard it described as. So, I'm curious as to what you make of that, of how we got there, and ultimately then what happened for the sort of the varying effects that we got in this country as a result.
Sure, yeah. So let's jump in on the impacts on the Caribbean and Florida, and then maybe a little time on climate change. So we were just talking, Puerto Rico avoided the worst of what we were worried about. Many residents there lost power, which unfortunately is a fairly typical thing. They've got an old, unreliable power grid. But over in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where I've spent a lot of time working on environmental problem solving there, there are three islands. And the biggest one, St. Croix, actually was not hit that hard. But St. Thomas and the little island of St. John, where 10,000 people live and half the island is a beautiful, beautiful national park, just took a head-on Category 5 hit. And my concern is there is an unfolding humanitarian crisis in the U.S. Virgin Islands today. No electricity, no drinking water, very little food. And I think we've been slow as a nation to recognize the problem. The national media, just in the last really 48 hours, has figured out the devastation that's going on there. FEMA is there, but in a limited way. The Red Cross just getting started. So I actually spent a good part of this week just personally calling congressional contacts that I have, saying, please look at this unfolding crisis. So we've got the immediate need of food and water. And then long term, you know, my guess is it will take months, if not years, to even get the electricity on again. So think of that. You know, it's terrible, the people in Florida, what they've gone through. But we all saw the image of the convoys of the utility trucks showing up in Florida. That can't happen on an island. And then, of course, other islands in the Caribbean, the British Virgin Islands, St. Martin, have all been devastated. So this is going to take a lot of money and ingenuity. The main economic driver in the U.S. Virgin Islands is tourism. Who's going to want to go there right. on vacation? Right. So it's a real challenge.
And for how long are they going to want to go there? In the sense of this is going to be
years.
I heard of what could happen, that it could be, the situation could be greatly improved in 6 to 9 months. But boy, you look at that. That doesn't seem like any way that you're rebuilding an entire infrastructure, right?
Right. It is an opportunity to rebuild in a better, more sustainable way. For instance, the power grid, you know, didn't work well on a sunny day if five people sneezed at the same time. And they have the most expensive electricity in the country, just around 50 cents per kilowatt hour, right behind Hawaii. And what always frustrated me when I was at EPA is there's virtually no solar and no wind. And it's so sunny and it's so windy there.
Right, it's right there. The resources are right there.
Yeah, you can't miss it. But there is a publicly owned utility. There's no competition. They run these really old, crotchety, crickety, oil-fired power plants, often running on diesel, so air quality is impacted. So I think long term, there's an opportunity to rebuild in an environmentally sustainable way. But what I'm really worried about is the next few days. Will people have food and water?
Right. And you look at the attention drawn to the Virgin Islands, especially in the last 48 hours. You know, we went from domestically Harvey, then to Irma, and obviously then the relief efforts. And certainly with Governor Cuomo flying down to the Virgin Islands today to meet with Governor Mapp and to assess the damage, it is going to be interesting to see, you know, what the attention span of political leaders it will be in the next few days and coming months and coming years to rebuild the Virgin Islands in a meaningful way.
Yeah, I commend Governor Cuomo for going there. He got there before President Trump did. I mean, President Trump went to Florida yesterday. I happened to look at his schedule today. He has some meetings, then he's heading to his New Jersey golf resort. Maybe he could have skipped golf this weekend and personally gone down to the U.S. Virgin Islands and assessed the damage, because there's really nothing like seeing it. And I don't use the phrase unfolding humanitarian crisis lightly. I mean, imagine you're in a large island, no electricity, no drinking water, no reliable sewage, and very little food.
So let's go over the president's words over the past several weeks. He has embraced both Harvey and Irma as major storms, and of course, has the hyperbole has been amazing, saying that, calling Harvey the worst storm hurricane they have ever seen, attributing that to many people say, for what it's worth. Mm-hmm. And then when Irma came, then that became a storm of epic proportion, perhaps bigger than we've ever seen. Be safe. Hurricane looks like the largest recorded in the Atlantic. So he seems to be more worried about the Guinness Book of World Records. But okay, we'll go with that. But when it turns out, Irma actually was. It was a hurricane for 12 days, and it was measuring as a major hurricane for more than 8 days. It's longer than any previous Atlantic storm. Mm-hmm. So then it's the worst is what he had been saying. So then when he was asked in Florida yesterday in viewing the damage of Irma, he was asked about the relationship between hurricanes and climate change, and his response, well, we've had much bigger storms than this. Trump pointed out storms a century ago that also did enormous damage as a way of playing down the relationship between the climate and this year's storm. So obviously you can't have it both ways, but not only the Trump response, but that of the entire administration and, of course, Scott Pruitt of the EPA, of the dismissal and saying that this isn't the proper time to discuss climate change, with the Republican mayor of Miami saying, if you don't talk about it now, when do you talk about it?
Yeah, this is a tremendous dereliction of duty, both for the president and, embarrassingly, the head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt. You know, there's never a good time with these guys to talk about climate change. And I think they're, you know, working off of talking points from the fossil fuel industry, the American Petroleum Institute. The messaging shift I've noticed in the past few days is they're starting to say, yes, these storms are a problem. Let's not debate the cause. Let's just deal with the relief efforts and helping to take care of people. I worked a lot on Hurricane Sandy. The fifth anniversary is coming up at the end of October. And I regularly said there will be more Sandys. Irma was worse than Sandy. Harvey was pretty bad and probably worse than Sandy. I mean, it all depends how you calculate the death and destruction and economic harm. But there will be more Harveys and more Irmas, and they're coming rapidly. They're stronger. And just give me 2 seconds here on the science of this, which is so important. The warmer the water temperature is, the more intense the storm. So we can't say that climate change causes hurricanes, but it makes the hurricane much more intense. The warmer water temperature is like rocket fuel. The warmer temperature also gives us, it heats the water, it causes more evaporation, and that means more moisture. So, as we saw in Houston, more rain. And then finally, distant melting glaciers contribute to sea level rise. And so when you have the problem of storm surge, it's more intense. What I just laid out in perhaps an inelegant way is what 99% of climate scientists agree on. And to have the head of the Environmental Protection Agency and Rick Perry at Department of Energy deny this is not a political debate. They are costing lives, and they're costing the economy literally hundreds of billions of dollars by taking such a irresponsible and poorly informed position, echoed right up to the president. And it's all because of the fossil fuel interests that dominate our national politics.
So what do we do about that? I mean, how do we get that? How do we... Let's even talk short term, because it doesn't seem like we're going to have a logical discussion on this, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like we're going to be able to sit down and go, no, I know you've hired the 1% of scientists who believe in this, but the 99% who don't work in your administration believe that this is happening.
Right.
Well, I would say right now, I mean, while the attention is on these storms right now, this is the time to do it. You know, as the mayor of Miami said, you know, when do you actually talk about it? And certainly, you know, when you look at crises and disasters, this is where things can actually get done. And there is a window of opportunity for us to actually substantially look at this and maybe change some decision makers' minds on the topic. But as Judith said, these 100-year storms are becoming every year to a devastating fashion and factor. So we have to do something about it. And I guess the question is, what more does it take to change the minds of those? You know, how many more lives have to be sacrificed to do that?
Well, I think the urgent thing is to drive down carbon pollution from electricity generation, from transportation, from buildings. Just yesterday, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced a very bold program to deal with energy efficiency at existing apartment buildings in New York City. Our own Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has launched an investigation of ExxonMobil looking at their role in denying climate change. Scientists at ExxonMobil predicted with certainty what was going to happen with climate change and yet denied it and funded climate denier groups. And so I think we've got to be bold in holding the fossil fuel companies accountable. It'll be really interesting to see where the Schneiderman investigation leads, and he's doing that along with the Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. There's a lot that states can do. There's a lot that private businesses can do. There's a lot we can do as individuals. But quite honestly, while we have a federal administration that is not only denying climate change, but is aggressively promoting fossil fuel extraction, including on public lands, I mean, these guys really want to ramp up coal, oil, gas extraction. While that's going on, I'm actually kind of pessimistic that state and private and local actions will cancel out the bad things coming out of Washington.
So if I want to go back to something you said earlier about there is an opportunity here, and let's just look at the Virgin Islands. So when you're starting, we only have about half a minute here, but as you're starting from scratch there, mm-hmm. do you think these wind opportunities and solar opportunities
yes.
will be incorporated, or do we not
yes.
even have?
No, I think they will. I think Governor Kenneth Mapp has been a strong supporter of renewable energy, but he inherited a really bad electricity grid. I think he and the residents, more importantly, I think the leadership will come from the local residents. They will want to rebuild in a sustainable way. But, you know, what a terrible way to get there.
Right.
We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Judah Thankus here, Joe Bonilla is here, and Malcolm Nance will be with us in just a moment. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We'll read some of your letters. We'll talk about some of the other major stories that are happening, including the bombing in London, North Korea, and other stories. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Judith Enk is here, Joe Bonilla, and soon Malcolm Nance will be with us. He is not running late. We knew he was going to be late because he has some MSNBC duties because of the bombing in London. So he'll be here. We just saw him on TV, and now he's not there. So we assume he's on his way.
He's a big shot.
Yeah.
Too big.
No offense to this Joe, but you're stuck with the small potatoes.
No, we're
okay.
He's fitting us in, and we're happy. That's
Superman.
Great.
We're still cool kids.
So you know, so what happens when you as the president, you side with the Democrats, and you start talking about Dreamers, you talk about DACA, and then you tick off your base, and you have all these right-wing talk shows kind of going against you. Well, what do? You then resurrect your claim that both sides shared blame in Charlottesville. And that's exactly what happened yesterday afternoon as the president spoke to reporters aboard Air Force One on his flight from Washington from Florida on Thursday afternoon, thrusting himself back into the racial storms of Charlottesville, repeating his charge that those who resisted the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists were as much to blame as the alt-right crowds who marched on the Virginia college town. I will also note that this is one day, yes, one day after, and hopefully you will help me here, when he met with the only African-American senator.
Yep.
Tim Scott, yes.
Tim
Scott.
White House got his name wrong.
Yes.
Yes. And said that they had a good constructive conversation, and then this.
It's, you know, the policy out of this White House is, you know, when there's issues on both sides, distract them with something else. And surely enough, you know, let's go back to what we've been talking about for the last 6 weeks. So this is again, back to the regular playbook of the Trump administration.
Well, it's kind of the greatest hits, right? You do this, you got to say, call her crooked Hillary again.
Right.
You go back to the hits.
Yeah, that's all it is. And you look at, you know, again, his meeting with Tim Scott, and, you know, you heard a senator say basically the president looked like he was paying attention and he was, you know, genuinely concerned with the senator's comments. And then to say the next day back to the both sides argument, again, it's stunning, but it's not totally out of the league for the president.
And I think it's actually, in this instance, a little productive because it reminds us of the details of what went on. It reminds us also how Trump went after President Obama's, where he was born, the whole birther controversy.
Which, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, Judith, but I was stunned. I was talking about this with my colleagues yesterday. So they removed the birther line from President Trump's corporate biography this week. And to which I responded, seriously, that was in his corporate biography?
Yeah, isn't
Good
that?
God.
That is how low it was with him. And he has, you know, a history with the Central Park Five and housing discrimination along with his father. And I want to use him bringing this up again to tell everyone to be sure to watch that video by Vice where they documented what went on over those 2 days. I just spoke in a classic CUNY journalism school 2 days ago where proudly my son graduated from a few years ago. And they were having the woman from Vice and the producers who made that video come in and speak at the journalism school just this week. And if you haven't watched it, it's only about 30 minutes, I think. Go to vice.com and watch that that video on that day and a half. And it just sticks with you and it haunts you. And every time Trump brings up two sides, I hope Vice gets a million clicks on that video.
If you just put in Vice News Charlottesville, it'll come right up. People have asked us that, and it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah, if you haven't, I'm sorry to be such a commercial here on this, but if you haven't watched it, watch it and grab your kids. And I think teachers should show that in their class and have a very open discussion about where we are as a nation on race.
So how do we move on from that, Joe? I mean, when you have that, Is that going to keep being resurrected again and again?
Well, for right now, basically, he's getting as many miles out of that line as he's trying to get out of it right now. And, you know, certainly we'll look at the next incident, if you will.
But it does damage every time he says it.
It does. But, you know, there is a base that this speaks to, and they love hearing it. You know, and so, again, when he's hearing issues on the base, again, versus his opponents, he will go back to the line which he believes himself will resurrect, you know, his standing with the base. And that's why I will say we'll see what happens in the fall and what other incidents could take place, and he'll obviously change up the line then. But for now, that is the line of the moment.
You don't think we'll ever hear that really awkward Monday speech that he gave before the press conference where he was reading from the teleprompter and said
that will absolutely happen again, but that will be followed by again what we saw, you know,
his true feeling.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
We have a bunch of letters. Let me get to those. Linda says, I've spent many wonderful vacations on St. John, a real paradise, and I'm heartbroken seeing photos of the destruction there. Can you recommend a fund that is specific to that island?
Yeah, St. John Community Foundation has set up a fund. I think they're pretty reputable, so check them out. I don't know them personally, but that's people whose opinion I respect have said donations to the St. John Community Foundation.
All right. Very good. Thank you. We also got this from Irene, who says, Judith, do you imagine a world where everyone can turn on their individual solar devices to power each house, business, school in the coming years?
Yes, we're getting there. The price of solar is coming down. The price of wind is coming down. If you want to create a lot of jobs, you invest in solar. Far more jobs are created from solar than coal.
Kathy says, I truly believe that one of the reasons Trump denies climate change is because he sees it as an anti-business, anti-money-making issue. The other reason is because he's a cold-hearted fool, oblivious to anything that affects anyone but him.
Well, valid statements in some regard. But I think it's always that mantra, that myth, that solar and renewable energy is, you know, anti-business. But, you know, we've seen time and time again coming out of the business community that, you know, renewable energy and looking into alternative sources of energy is actually good for business.
Yeah, and let's not forget that our Secretary of State is the former CEO of ExxonMobil. So I think on the economics, renewables and energy efficiency wins the day, hands down. And I think Trump is about 15 years behind the times on the economics of energy. Right. But when you put the CEO of ExxonMobil in charge of the State Department, he has a particular worldview that embraces oil, gas, coal.
Right.
Barbara, a little geography here. Barbara writes that I never heard of Barbuda until the hurricane. People were evacuated to St. Croix. Is it part of the U.S. Virgin Islands?
No, no. U.S. Virgin Islands is the three main islands, St. Thomas, St. Croix, St. John, and then a bunch of tiny little islands that no one has ever heard of, like Water Island, where I think Joe Biden's brother has a house. But it's really just mostly St. Croix, St. John, and St. Thomas, and I might add tremendous poverty on St. Croix and St. Thomas. In St. Croix, they lost their biggest employer, the Hovenza oil refinery, which was half owned by the government of Venezuela. And I was really worried if the hurricane hit there, what that would do. And it's an interesting dynamic in U.S. Virgin Islands. St. John is small. As I mentioned, half the island is a beautiful national park, which is also decimated. It's a lot of people from outside. You know, they retire there or they're from Texas or the South, artsy, whereas, and I love it, but I equally love St. Thomas, which is much more urban and a tremendous amount of poverty.
We got this from Martin, who writes, Judith, do you think the private industry and the economics of green energy can pick up the slack left by the federal government?
To a degree. And that is a little bit of hope. I mean, I think a lot of the large energy companies are almost ignoring what President Trump and Pruitt are doing. But they can do it to a degree. But having the United States pull out of the Paris Accord and having the United States government not just being climate deniers, but aggressively promoting fossil fuel extraction and fossil fuel infrastructure like pipelines and compressor stations will cancel out a lot of the good work by states and the private sector, I am afraid.
But you also have, obviously, the U.S. Climate Alliance with a number of states and, you know, communities as well. So that, do you think that will maybe counteract, obviously, the federal government's withdrawal from that?
A bit, but not enough in terms of what has to happen to avoid catastrophic climate change.
Let's go to just a few more letters, and then we'll take a break here. Al writes, I am also pessimistic, Judith. We have had Sandy Hook, and Congress did nothing for gun control. The solution is to hit Americans in the wallet, tax gas heavily, which could pay for many needed projects like healthcare and the infrastructure. Anne writes, the U.S. government will continue to deny global warming until and unless ExxonMobil and the other major fossil companies figure out a way to monopolize solar and water power. Then we will see devout attention to that issue.
I've been waiting for Exxon to shift into renewables, and they haven't. They run ads on algae. They've been running that same ad for about 25 years. But for some reason, they're not pivoting.
Mary writes, is it true that Mike Pence and other politicians believe in the rapture and equate it with climate change? If so, how do we challenge people's religious beliefs that are threatening to destroy our planet?
I have no idea.
That beats me on that one almost. But, you know, I think it's one of those things where, you know, the more and more people see, again, the devastation and the crisis that comes from storms, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's a winter storm, whatever it might be, things that clearly there is human impact from it. You know, whatever way we have to get people to think about these issues in a meaningful way and find solutions, let's figure it out.
And remember, a big chunk of the West has been on fire.
I mean, not
just California and Oregon, but Montana. And interestingly, the federal government has told the governor of Oregon that they're not going to pay for all of this damage and all of the costs related to fighting the wildfires. We also had major loss of life in Sierra Leone just recently because of flooding and mudslides in India. This is a worldwide crisis. And interestingly, the federal agency, and Malcolm has mentioned this in the past, the federal agency that is more on top of climate change than any other is the Department of Defense, because they see what's going on around the globe.
And finally, before we go to the break, Jeremy writes, as progressives, we need a little truth to power talking to the base. Yes, there are risks, but fracking has done more for reducing CO2 emissions by swapping coal for natural gas than agreements and laws. Let's not have our own denier problem.
Well, I disagree with that. I think certainly as the cost of gas has come down, that you can attribute to fracking. But, you know, fracking has lots of methane emissions associated with it if you look at the life cycle of fracking, and some very significant water problems. So I don't think we can frack our way out of the climate crisis. And I commend Governor Cuomo for saying no to fracking. And recently, the Delaware River Basin Commission said no to fracking. But unfortunately, it's happening all over the rest of the country. And those methane emissions are really going to damage the planet.
We'll take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning, the 15th of September, just about 10 minutes before the hour of 10 o'clock. We want to just hit a couple of stories before the top of the hour. Judith Angus here, Joe Bonilla, and we welcome your letters. Let's talk about the what many are calling the Chuck and Nancy show.
It's a 50s
situation. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
An unexpected meeting of the minds between President Trump and Democratic leaders on Thursday made real a possible deal in Congress to pair enhanced border security with legislation to protect young undocumented immigrants brought to the country as children. One day after Mr. Trump hosted Senator Chuck Schumer and Representative Nancy Pelosi for dinner at the White House, the president said he could support legislation to protect the young immigrants known as Dreamers from deportation if it were accompanied by a massive border security upgrade. Acceding to a key Democratic demand, Mr. Trump said such a package did not need to have funding for a border wall. It was the second time this month that a tentative agreement announced by Democrats left Republican leaders in Congress scrambling to adjust a legislative agenda that appears increasingly set by the party out of power in the House, the Senate, and the White House. You don't even know what to say, do you? We're working on a plan for DACA, Mr. Trump told reporters, referring to protections for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program as he prepared to leave the White House for Florida. The wall will come later. And Republican leaders at least sounded open to pursuing it. We're not going to bring a solution to the floor that does not have the support of President Trump, said Speaker Paul Ryan. But if Mr. Trump does support an immigration package that includes security and enforcement, he said, so will a majority of our members because our members support President Trump. So there.
Well, you know, it's certainly going the back and forth in terms of messaging. You know, you had, Senator Schumer and Representative Pelosi coming out of the meeting and saying that they have this, quote unquote, agreement with the president on DACA. And then the next day having the president say, well, you know, we have this discussion, but, you know, about the wall, and then backtracking on the wall, which was his signature campaign item, and saying, well, the wall will come later. Well, how much later, you know, for him? In terms of, you know, fulfilling a campaign promise, at least in for his base. So it's interesting to see, you know, how he's trying to also commingle having this coalition of Democrats together with him to actually move forward his agenda, in his opinion.
Okay, but the agenda. So let's talk about what the agenda is. So we know what the political, what the campaign agenda is, but it seems to be that he wants wins, he wants results, and he also, in that, if he can get a little revenge along the way, all the better.
He wants to appear that he's winning. You know, I think the calculus in terms of what a win is a little bit different. But if he can be seen as being this deal maker and creating deals, that's winning for him. Whether or not it actually goes through, as we've seen throughout his entire presidency, remains to be seen about what actual win means for him.
Well, I think Senator Schumer is being masterful in the way he is handling this. He knows, as Joe said, that the president wants a deal no matter what it looks like. And in this one instance, this could be a really positive thing. I mean, I keep thinking about the almost 800,000 productive young dreamers who don't know what's going on with their life. And, you know, I was always puzzled why Trump made such a strong, terrible announcement on the Dreamers and then like 12 hours later backtracked from it. But if he's backtracking, I think that's a good thing for the country. And let's not remind him that he's backtracking. I mean, I think this little bromance with Schumer and Trump is not going to be long-lived, so let's get as much good policy out of it as we can. I'm also curious what Jeff Sessions thinks of all of this. I don't want to jump ahead, Joe.
No,
but
you can. I was going to. The Jeff Sessions story, of course, is that that came out of the New York Times about how he was humiliated and basically was asked for his resignation, gave it, and then it was rebuffed.
And the reason Sessions stuck around was to do his terrible anti-immigration policies. Remember, he was the one who went to the podium to announce DACA, and he stood alone. And now, the president
right.
is running away. And so, you know, for Sessions, what is the point of him staying? He was attacked by the president, humiliated, said he was staying around to do immigration, and now that changes. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a Sessions exit at some point, and then that creates a whole cavalcade of problems for the president with the Senate, where Sessions still has a fan base.
And also among conservatives, where this issue obviously is very important as well.
Well, Ann Coulter, if I dare say, Ann Coulter on Twitter.
Don't
say it three times fast.
She tweeted yesterday that if Trump proceeds with what he agreed to with Chuck and Nancy, she said, why not? Just impeach him. He's done. Impeach him.
Laura Ingraham had similar comments. Rush Limbaugh yesterday said, well, let's just see it out. We think this is a strategy that the president has, and I think if we stick with him, we'll see that we get what we want. So,
but remember, the president acts on whoever talks to him last, so this may change.
Right.
And I think Chuck and Nancy have to move fast, but we also have to recognize that McConnell and Paul Ryan control the calendar, what comes up. So, you know, there are still major players here.
Right. And I think the one thing the speaker said, and he emphasized that they had a discussion. This is not an agreement.
Right. They said they had an agreement to reach an agreement.
But the
outlines of that agreement sounded pretty positive.
Right.
But Joe, I mean, we also are up against the clock here, too, as far as the 2018 elections, right?
Right. So you're looking at, you know, different ways he can be seen as a deal maker in that way. So obviously this right here, looking at trying to forge a coalition, if you will, a Trump coalition, if you will. It remains to be seen.
We had an over-under when we said at the beginning of the program that Malcolm Nance would be joining us, and we were watching him on television, and he was looking very natty in a three-piece suit. And then what the over-under was on whether he would arrive here in a suit. You're not wearing a suit.
No, it's still in the
big
studio.
Disappointment.
I'm
going
to go back at least three more times today. So you get slacker look.
No, it's good. We like the relaxed Malcolm look. All right, we're gonna take a break. And when we come back, Malcolm Nance is here. We're going to talk about all the other stuff going on in the world. We want to talk about what happened in London, of course. We want to talk about North Korea. And we'll cover all of that with Malcolm Nance and our panel after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Let me introduce the panel to you. Judith Enck is here, a former EPA regional administrator. Communications consultant Joe Bonilla is with us, and counterterrorism expert and MSNBC commentator Malcolm Nance is with us, and just on MSNBC moments ago talking about the situation in London. And there was a crude bomb striking the London subway, injuring commuters. I believe the number we have currently is 23 that were hospitalized. So let us go to you, sir, first, Malcolm Nance, as to what we can make out of anyone who has been watching television and not the radio, although the radio did a good job of describing it this morning, of this white bucket.
Yeah, I got a text message this morning about 1 minute after the device had gone off, and somebody, a counterterrorism person in Europe, said, "Hey, we've got this thing," and people are tweeting pictures of the device, and there's a photo of it you'll see on the internet, and MSNBC investigative confirmed it that this was a bucket that looks like a 5 gallon paint drum that was left in a little supermarket plastic bag. And there appears to be some flames coming out of it. Now, what's interesting about this is that improvised explosive devices, and that's what this was. Anything that's amateur, that's not factory built, is improvised. And if it explodes, it's an explosive device. So this IED, this improvised explosive device, created a flash of flame enough to create a small fireball, but flash only affects the skin portions of your body when it's out there. It had no sustaining explosive power. Also, it wasn't contained in a traditional metal container, which creates overpressure, and that overpressure explodes the container and turns it into shrapnel. So that's unusual, too. My first thought was, clearly this was some sort of either a chemical or a gas. And we're going to wait to see what Scotland Yard has to say about it. But it was either designed to create a chemical reaction, which could have led to a gas, or it was a container like a propane canister inside, or an industrial spray that you puncture, and that creates a gas cloud, which could then be ignited, which would create a flash device. But it's not a traditional bomb.
So would it have? Was it designed to hurt or to maim more people than were? Then we're affected on
Well, all terrorist attacks are pretty much designed to hurt as many people as possible. This one's interesting because it was literally, there's video of it, minutes after the device went off where it's still burning, but it's not consuming the container. And that's where guys like me, we look at it, I've seen hundreds, if not thousands of devices, and I've survived real IEDs, right? So we look at this and we go, what was the purpose
you guys,
of that?
Yeah, all of us, yes. We've all survived.
Sorry, it's just one of those career
Okay, you
things.
Win that one, Malcolm.
My man card's punched. But when we look at the container and the way that it injured people was just that initial flash.
Right, so it burned their skin.
Right. Yeah, you get like a third, a third degree burn, like a sunburn. The woman who was closest to it clearly had the burns across her legs and had to be stretched out. A lot of people are injured on the panic as you rush out of the subway like that. But the video I saw, which was within 2 or 3 minutes of it, where the door was still open on the train, people were just milling about it. And there didn't seem to be a lot of panic other than the people in the car itself. So I think that Scotland Yard and other intelligence agencies are going to take a very strong look at the contents to see, was it an explosive? Or, as I'm starting to suspect, was it a chemical device designed to create a choking gas or something, and it misfired, and we're all very lucky.
And we don't know who, in situations like this, you don't know who's behind it, but because it seemed to be rather crude, would that mean that it isn't, it's somebody who could be working separately, although...
No, this is what you call a class 5 terrorist, right? This is an amateur. Class 1 is like North Korean intelligence, right? A government, trained agency that's acting as a terrorist. Class 2 are the lifelong professionals. Class 3 are insurgents. Class 4 are, paramilitaries. Class 5 are just people on the street.
So it's the opposite of the hurricane ratings.
Yes.
Class 5 is the worst.
So these guys are real. Whoever did this, it was a crude device. It was amateurish. But, Timothy McVeigh was a class 5 terrorist and blew up a federal building. So you have to take every one of these incidents very seriously.
And what I'm worried about is, how do you protect a mass transit system? It's not like
when
you go to the airport, you go through what I think is an inadequate TSA screen. And you can't do that with New York City.
Right, buses,
millions
subways,
of
everything.
People.
You know, infrastructure, it's very hard to protect. And that's the whole basis of terrorism. And the way to stop terrorism is to stop the underlying cause, and to neutralize the cells and nodes that are carrying out these things. But, I gave a speech a few years ago in South Africa called Fighting from the Curb, and how terrorists were going to stop going into the security area and start attacking from the curb inward.
Yeah, the trucks, the cars.
And we've seen that. Yeah. We saw that in Scotland. We saw it in Belgium. Terrorists aren't stupid. They're adaptive. Yeah. They're very... average 3 people in a room could come together with some horrific
But Malcolm, plans. I want to focus on what you said about dealing with the source of it. Because if you look at the American resources spent on, understandably, trying to protect our country versus the resources and the intellectual capital used on going to the source of it, there's quite a disconnect.
There was a good effort occurring in the last half of the Obama administration,
right.
in a field that, you know, I wrote three books on what we call counter ideology, how to defeat the actual belief system of the ISIS and Al-Qaeda style Islamic, you know, terrorist cult. And to recognize that, you have to understand there were four other cults in Islam before them, and they were quashed. I mean, including one terrorist group in the 10th century that destroyed Mecca, raised it to the ground because they thought going there was idolatry. So these things, you have to approach them, you know, with a real academic mind as opposed to a shooter's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest advocates you'll see for that are the shooters, you know, the people who were in defense.
Right.
We would rather just kill this using soft power rather than having to do a kinetic operation, which is, you know, putting hard metal through human beings, because it's easier to do. But also, as you see, as ISIS is destroyed, the ideology is still out there. The belief system is still out there. And we refuse to try to confront that, even though I've written two menus on how to do that. But the first problem that we have amongst the U.S. government is, oh, we're not going to talk about Islam. Well, you don't even get the Muslims to talk about Islam.
Right.
And the Muslims are dying. The Muslim world is dying to confront that. But, you know, when you have people in the administration who think Islam itself is the problem, you've just validated everything Osama bin Laden and ISIS have always said about the West, and you recruit for them.
So in the time that we have left, I do also want to talk about North Korea, as was reported and as we know. They have launched another missile, escalating the crisis once again. And a ballistic missile over Japan on Friday, a direct challenge to the U.S. and China just days after new sanctions resolution adopted by the U.N. Security Council that was intended to force the country to halt the nuclear missile tests. The missile was not aimed at the Pacific island of Guam, which President Trump had warned could prompt a military response after North Korea threatened to fire missiles into the sea near the island last month. Where is this leading?
Well, you know, I find it interesting that everybody views that these missile launches are you know, provocations and another notch in the escalation. You know, they've got to test their systems, too, just as we test ours. It's just that North Korea knows that every time they advance in any, you know, ballistic missile system, that it's going to peak Donald Trump. And they are look, this is a nation that for 64 years have been the master of the troll.
Right.
I mean, every communication that comes out of North Korea is designed to provoke. And so long as you allow that provocation to ratchet it up into tensions, which could lead to armed conflict, they're going to win, because there's no winning an armed conflict here. It just is not. So, you know, this missile was an intercontinental ballistic missile. You know, the question is, you know, we say, oh, well, it wasn't aimed at Guam. Well, we have this thing called mirror imaging. What you do is you track out the length of the flight of that missile, and then you swing it south to see if it was just put on a same range as Guam. So, you know, they could easily test against Guam without aiming at it.
Right.
But it's not Guam you have to worry about. It's Tokyo.
Right.
You know, North Korea's capacity to nuke Tokyo, to nuke Seoul, although they wouldn't do that. Beijing, Anchorage, you know, and now possibly Seattle. And that's what you're betting on when you open your mouth and say, we're going to do something about North Korea. You've bet the lives of those about 25 million citizens.
And remember what the president said was a few weeks ago was fire and fury. And hopefully he won't say that again today. What I thought was interesting was just the public attention on the situation, which I think is good. We should all pay attention. But North Korea launched the same number of missiles last year as they did this year. But this president reacts in a profoundly different way, which I think has us all extremely concerned, because he does not get the nuance of diplomacy.
No, he wants to provoke.
Yeah. And, you know, and then, in his defense, if I can say that phrase, sanctions are not working. But you have to do sanctions. You have to do diplomacy, because militarily, we just don't have a move there.
I meant to bring this up during our discussion about London real quick, because the president did tweet another attack in London by a loser terrorist. These are sick and demented people who were in the sights of Scotland Yard. Must be proactive! And then loser terrorists must be dealt with in a much tougher manner. The internet is their main recruitment tool, and we must cut off and use better. What does that mean?
You know, we have this thing when I was in the military, and I was training at the Navy Survival School. I ran the Terrorism Survival School, and one of the things that we taught our operators, you know, SEAL team operators, was very simple: never issue a personal challenge to a terrorist. Okay, and when you call them a loser, all they have to do is go do one win, all right? And they will use your own words against you. You have to, you know, there's a million years of knowledge now that we've collected since 9/11 in which how to confront this. But Donald Trump speaks in these five-year-old terms because he doesn't know any better. And no matter how many discussions he has with General McMaster and General Mattis, this is the way he thinks.
So you're saying that because if you call somebody a loser, then they're going to prove to you they're not. And if they do that to be a successful terrorist, you kill one person.
Yeah.
Or 50. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, they will now prioritize their targeteering, as we say, where they will say, okay, all we need to do is, you know, I need one American with a rifle from a Walmart to step into a McDonald's and shoot five people. But that's the way he speaks. They will use those words against them. They already have. And New Scotland Yard came and MI5 came right out and said, look, this language does not help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, remember just a few months ago when the president attacked the mayor of London middle of him dealing with a terrorist attack there. I know that President Trump never, ever wants anyone to take control of his Twitter feed. But I think on national security issues, they have to reach an agreement. And on terrorism issues, that he runs his tweets by people, or he's sending us right off the cliff.
But this baby talk works. Yeah. For his
well, you know, right. He hasn't commented this morning yet on North Korea on Twitter, so we have no idea what he's thinking right now.
No, and the latest tweet was about the travel ban. The travel ban into the United States should be far larger, tougher, and more specific, but stupidly, that would not be politically correct. Mm.
You mean like Saudi Arabia? The 19 hijackers that did 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Our two largest partners in the Middle East.
And then we have made more progress in the last 9 months against ISIS than the Obama administration has made in 8 years. Must be proactive and nasty.
That is a lie. I really bugs me when I hear stuff like that. Interesting fact. I wrote a book a year and a half ago called Defeating ISIS. Donald Trump told Time magazine last August that was the last book he read. It's 544 pages.
He may be lying.
ISIS.
Is it books on tape?
This,
is it on
right,
tape?
Right.
It's got 80 pages of references.
The cliff notes. Yeah.
He colored it lovely.
It's got maps and drawings in there, and a lot of pictures. But the war against ISIS. First off, ISIS didn't manifest itself on a large scale until 2014. Even though it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq before that. We all remember them. They killed 4,490 American soldiers. Obama administration put it to these people. Before this January, we had killed over 30,000 ISIS. What happened last December to change the dynamic? The Iraqi army dedicated 500,000 men to go and take back ISIS's territory. They lost 1,700 combatant troops just in the Battle of Mosul. They fought this war. Our special operations guys stood back 2 miles and put down bomb and air control where we needed it. But the Iraqis, the Syrian Kurds, are the people who are losing blood to fight ISIS. Those gains are theirs, not ours. But to get those gains, we needed that 2 years of bombing literally every ISIS position, tank, truck, and building that we did under the Obama administration. So it's like Truman coming in '45 and saying, you know, I've done everything since Pearl Harbor, right? Which he didn't do, of course, but it was all FDR. Trump doesn't see it that way. Anything that happens is his. And that's an insult to the Iraqis and the Syrians and the others who were on the ground fighting this fight, hammer and tong, and actually are losing the people for it. We've lost, I think, 3 people this year due to accidents and combat action.
I like your point, though, about the you know, these tweets. Some of this should be vetted.
Yeah, the stakes are too high.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
nominally
one,
at
it's,
least.
It's one yes. thing when he's attacking his political opponents, but when he's weighing in on terrorism and national security, General Kelly just has to grab the flip phone from him and say, just let me read it before it goes out. He's going to get us into another nuclear catastrophe over tweeting,
right.
For goodness sakes.
And God forbid spell check. Right.
God forbid spell check. That's absolutely right. You know, believe it or not, we got through all the stories. I don't know. So I just have a couple letters. We'll get to those just as we finish out our last couple minutes. A lot of these, Eric says, I keep asking myself how much more efficient the Florida evacuation would have been if there was little to no dependence on fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Meaning you got to get in your car and you got to get out of there.
Eh, I mean, yeah, but
sail out on your solar car,
right?
But I don't think that's the point.
Jeff Sessions, he will stick around so that he can continue to spread racism through the land. He is an ideologue, although his ideals are anything but ideal.
Can I make a comment about that? I know I
yes.
missed that segment. I thought that report from the New York Times about Sessions being fired was fascinating. This is literally buckets of fuel on the impeachment and obstruction of justice charges. I mean, mm-hmm. that he was mad at the attorney general because the attorney mm-hmm. general recused himself so he could not stop a federal a national counterintelligence investigation is just insane.
Come
I mean,
on, Malcolm,
does he
it's all
want
about
to
loyalty.
Be
right. Loyalty,
does
loyalty,
he want
loyalty.
To be out of the office? His personal loyalty supersedes law. And I think he thinks the attorney general is the White House
right.
counsel.
Right. Right.
He doesn't seem to understand that they don't work for him. And that's, you know, but for Sessions to stand there and take it, mm-hmm. that tells you all you need to know. I mean, he wanted to do immigration so he wouldn't quit.
Right. And now he may yeah. not get what he wants on there.
Right. Holy cow. I mean, if that had been done to me, that I would have taken out my iPhone. I would have turned it on to film and you would have watched the biggest presidential butt kicking on video for posterity. I would
right.
have stopped it at the end of that chewings, resigned on
all
the
right.
spot,
yep.
and handed it over to the Smithsonian.
I don't want to kick a guy when he's down, but I'm pretty sure he probably doesn't know how to use that phone. I'm just
yeah.
guessing.
Yeah.
Just guessing.
Give it to an aide.
Malcolm Nance, Joe Bonilla, Judith Eng, a pleasure to have you all here. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Thanks for spending time
Thanks.
With us this morning. We welcome you and your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back with more show. Booger is going to be with us from Revenge of the Nerds. Curtis Armstrong, he'll join us after this.